Okay, thank you for coming, everybody. Just out of curiosity, sort of a social experiment, for how many of you is this theorem of the title a familiar term, the Riesch-Lieder theorem?
Oh, the Taj Mahal. No.
Oh, the Taj Mahal, okay. Okay, yeah. No, the Riesch-Lieder theorem. Roughly about half. Okay. Good. Because I was hoping that for some of you will be at least unfamiliar with it. It's a 50-year-old theorem, actually a little more than 50 years old because it was first published in 1961. It's not the sort of thing that you see in your standard introduction to quantum field theory textbooks. I went through, a bunch of them and didn't see it mentioned, except in those things like Hogg's book or the Streeter and Whiteman book or things like that are, really written by mathematical physicists, aimed at people who want everything nice, clean. Those sort of books where everything is well-defined mathematically, and they never actually get around to calculating any cross-sections. What it says is, roughly, and I'll make a more precise statement, is under fairly mild assumptions about what kind of quantum field theory you have, and I'll be more specific about those in a moment, then I'm assuming you've got field operators associated with points, and you can smear those over space-time regions with appropriate test functions form operators, and take some open region of space-time. It can be a small one, it can be a bounded one. It says any state in the theory can be approximated arbitrarily closely by acting on the vacuum with an operator associated with that region. That strikes some people as counterintuitive. Here's a quote from Rainer Werch. This result by Riesch-Lieder appears entirely counterintuitive since it says that every state of the theory can be approximated to arbitrary precision by acting with operators or operations localized in any arbitrarily given space-time region on the vacuum. To state it in a rather more drastic and provocative way, which I learned from Reinhard Werner, by acting on the vacuum with suitable operations in a terrestrial laboratory, an experimenter can create the Taj Mahal on or even behind the moon. Since I wanted to use that quote and I didn't want to misquote him, I actually emailed Werner to check that he had actually said that, and he was kind enough to actually send me a slide that he used a number of years ago in a talk. And so he calls it the Taj Mahal principle. And I like the way he puts it, because there's a device for Alice like that if she sees a click, she can be sure that Bob, who is light years away, sees any specified state. And I actually think that's a nice, careful way to put it. And then he said, pretty damn unlikely. But the idea is non-zero probability. So the idea is there is some local operation that Alice can do. And if she gets a certain result on her apparatus, a yes on the thing, she can be all virtually certain that for any state of the world you might want, that if she sees a click, that Bob arbitrarily far away is going to see whatever that state is. First part of the talk is I want to convince you, those of you who actually haven't heard of this theorem before, and those who have, that's not counterintuitive. In fact, it doesn't really require any deep, abstruse mathematics, despite the impression might you get from some of these books to talk about it. And if you've taken an elementary quantum field theory course, even if you dozed off after the first few chapters of the book, it follows straight, solves in a few lines from stuff you already know. Yeah.
Just a real quick question. Does this have to be an interacting field theory or?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Chosen Minkowski space-time.
What's that?
I What about curved space-time?
What about curved space-time? That's a good question because, as you know, quantum field theory is a lot more complicated on curved space-time. There are analogs of it, and you know, if you can approximate your space-time as locally Minkowski, then you're still going to get something like something like that. At least you'll get something like that. I can't. That's hedged. For the purpose of this talk, we're doing quantum theory in Minkowski space-time. Yeah. Okay. So first, I want to convince you it's not as counterintuitive as it sounds. Nevertheless, thinking about it can be useful in thinking about how relativistic causality is actually implemented in quantum field theory, because you know the way it's sometimes glossed, though, in that quote that I had from Werner, it isn't. You know, sometimes people say, "Well, I can instantaneously create something at at the other end of the universe or something." And there are worries about whether that fits, that meshes with relativistic causality. The short answer is, of course it is, does, because we're working in a relativistic theory. But it's interesting to see how it does. Okay. All right. So we're going to assume I've got some kind of quantum field theory. I've got some kind of field operators, or they're actually operator value distributions, the yield operators when you smear them, but I'm going to use the usual terminology and call them field operators. I'm assuming your observables are operators that are formed out of those things from some kind of linear combinations or polynomials of those things, products and things like that, smeared with appropriate test functions. And you just take any space-time region R, and we draw it over here. I'm going to be referring to it again and again. And given a such region, I can say, okay, you know what? There's going to be an algebra of operators associated with that region, formed by smearing polynomials in the fields with test functions that vanish outside of that region. Okay. Here is what we're going to assume. We're going to assume that we have a unitary group of operators implementing space-time translations. That's all already going to be a little bit problematic in a curved space-time, but we're working in a Minkowski space-time. And assume that I do have self-adjoint operators that are generators of those corresponding to the energy momentum. I assume that I do have some state, vacuum state, ground state, that is invariant under all those translations. And this is part of what makes the theorem work, is the spectrum of those generators or translations is in the positive light cone. Really, a way to think about it is that particles in the theory, they have positive energy. And the usual justification for that, I mean, that is a usual situation, is, well, you know what? If you haven't got a lower bound on the energy, you can just have complete instability because you can just cascade downward and downward and downward into lower and lower energy states. Okay. And so we've got this vacuum state is in our Hilbert space, or this vector corresponding to the vacuum state. We're going to want to have any vector that we can get by operating with these operators I've been talking about. And the assumption is you don't have anything more, anything more than you need in order to do that. So it's sort of the, it's the minimal Hilbert space that contains the vacuum and is closed under those all those polynomials, all those polynomial operators. So you just take. Although, you know, take the set of set of vectors you get by operating the vacuum with all those operators I was talking about, take the norm closure of that, there's your Hilbert space. Okay. The theorem itself does not require microcausality. It is a theorem about, it is relativistic quantum field theories, and you might think, okay, this is the relativistic axiom par excellence because it ensures that operations, an operation that Alice can do in her lab doesn't affect the probability of any outcome of any experiment that Bob can do at space-like separation. That's not needed for the Riesz-Lehr theorem itself, but I will be invoking it for some things that follow from it. Okay. All right, so here's how it works. Given any open region A, take a subspace. A subspace that starts with the vacuum and it consists of the vectors you get by acting on the vectors you get by acting on the vacuum with operators associated that with that region, you know, smeared with functions that vanish outside that region. And prima facie, you might think, okay, and then take the smallest, you know, the smallest subspace containing all of those. Prima facie, you might think, okay, if that's just a little region, that is going to be a minuscule subspace of my whole Hilbert space. And what the theorem says is...
That kind of region, does it have to be non-zero measure?
It just has to contain an open set.
But in space-time.
In space-time, yeah. Yeah, open in space-time, yeah. Yeah, so... Can't be just part of one time slice. Thank you. Yeah, so it has to, any open region, open in space-time, yes. Okay. And the theorem is that actually, no, those subspaces are not proper subspaces for any open region, the subspace you get by acting upon the vacuum with operators associated with that region is actually the entire Hilbert space. Okay. And that sounds surprising. But what I want to claim is that it follows fairly straightforward from things that are either known to you from the introductory chapters of a quantum field theory book, even before they get the interacting theories, when they're still talking about the free fields, or will not come as a surprise to you. Okay, and the way to do it, I think the easiest way to think about this theorem is just to do it in steps. So first of all, I'm just going to pick one of the fields in the theory. And talk about the one particle sector associated with that field. So operate on the vacuum with field with creation operators corresponding to that field, and take the set of states of those form. So for any appropriate x. So it's the one particle Hilbert space corresponding to my field phi alpha, and take that one particle subspace, and again, for any region, open region R, we'll get a subspace of that, which are spanned by vectors where we restrict of that form, where we restrict ourselves to F with support in R. And sort of the baby Lorentz-Schroeder theorem for this one particle sector is that for any open region R, that subspace actually is the entire one particle subspace.
You have a question open.
Yeah.
Were you assuming, we're not assuming free fields now.
No, we're not assuming
so
anything.
This is just calling it phi dagger is just some name or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not assuming they're free
so
fields.
I don't know what is H alpha.
What's
H
that?
H alpha is defined what you can get by using F of any support, is that right?
Yeah, any support, yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm not assuming free fields. All I'm assuming is that whatever they do, however they evolve, the time translations are given by a Hamiltonian with a positive spectrum. That's all I'm assuming.
So the integral over the whole space-time, the Hilbert space from that is the same as the integral over this open region.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
No matter how small.
Yeah, that's the claim.
And alpha's just a label.
Alpha's just our labels, yes. Yeah,
you could have left the dagger out.
I could have, yes. I could have left the dagger out, yes. I just put them because, I don't know, I feel better about thinking them as creation operators with the daggers on them. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Because, yeah, I could just relabel it and turn phi alpha dagger into phi alpha, right? Yeah. They're just labels, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, so the claim is that, yeah, take one field, take all the states that can be formed by, letting F go over the whole, all of Minkowski space, take a subspace that where you restrict it to with F in support and R, and actually, that's not a proper subspace. That's the whole thing.
And there's no assumption about whether the field operators commute or anti-commute or any
nope.
of that stuff.
Nope. No assumption whatsoever. The only thing that's going into that is the only thing that's really going into it is the assumption, the spectrum condition. That you've got generators of space-time translations. So if I have, a field at one point, I can do a translation and get the field at any other point, and the operators that generate that.
Positive spectrum.
Yep. Yeah, that's the only assumption. No assumption that they commute space like separation or anything like that. Okay. All right. And here it is. Well, you can for things in that subspace, you can define wave functions. And it turns out that anything in that subspace is actually uniquely characterized by its wave function. And here is the thing that makes everything work. It follows from the positive spectrum condition by a theorem called, in complex analysis, called the edge of the wedge theorem, is that if that wave function vanishes everywhere in some open set R, it vanishes everywhere. So you can't have something that's non-zero somewhere and is zero in some open set. And the reason I claim that, so the work comes in showing that follows only from the spectrum condition. But I'm claiming it shouldn't be surprising if you've played a little bit with the theory of free fields or even the simplest possible quantum field theory, scalar field, free field, because if you have, you're familiar with the fact that the propagator doesn't vanish at space-like separation. Yeah?
Should I then think about this is like some sort of, this is like for analytical functions that if they vanish in threat. So should I think about somehow the positive spectrum condition burying that in there somewhere?
What the theorem is that if you've got
besides the positive spectrum condition, there doesn't seem to be anything about being analytic, is there?
That's the interesting thing is that Yeah, besides the positive spectrum condition, and we're actually using the fact that the vacuum, the thing that's there on the left, is invariant under translation, so that can be relaxed. Those two things are enough to show that the functions are analytic. Yeah, right. That's the edge of the wedge theorem.
Yeah,
it's good. Yeah.
You say translation invariants can be relaxed?
What's that?
You say translation invariants can be relaxed?
So what I've got there on the left is a translation invariant state. And there's a generalization. It doesn't have to be a translation invariant state. It just, I'll get to the generalization in a moment. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. And once you get that, like if you find, if you find this unsurprising, then that what I call the baby Rieschlieder theorem, the one particle sector version of it shouldn't be surprising, because if I take if that subspace isn't the whole of some space, then there must be something in, actually should be H alpha there, that's in its orthogonal to everything in that subspace, because it's a closed subspace. And if I take anything in that subspace for any function f, take the inner product, then it's just the integral of f times the wave function. If this thing vanishes whenever f has support in our region R for all functions such that f has the support in region R, the only way that can have that is that vanishes everywhere in R, or at least almost everywhere. So it follows in two lines from that unsurprising fact that there, for any regions no matter how small, any open region no matter how small, in our one particle subspace there isn't anything anything that's orthogonal in H alpha of R. And that's it. Okay. Now you can do it for, you can pick two fields and run exactly the same argument. And then you can pick any sequence of fields, no matter what fields you have, and do it for that sequence. Okay. Just repeat, Pete. So anything that's in the orthogonal complement of the subspace I get by acting on the vacuum with operators associated with R, it has to be in the orthogonal complement of those subspace consisting of smearing products of n fields of a certain form, and hence by the same argument that I gave for the one particle subspace, orthogonal to everything when I lift the restriction that the operator is associated with R. And if I've got something orthogonal to all those, I said at the beginning my Hilbert space was the smallest Hilbert space containing all those. And so there's no non-zero vector in my Hilbert space that's orthogonal to everything that you can get by operating with things associated with R. So it's basically, the argument is a repeat over and over again of the argument I gave for the simplest case where I'm acting with just one field on the vacuum. And So what I can claim is, if that, you know, if what I call it unsurprising fact one, what struck you as unsurprising, then the full-blown Reeder theorem should think you, strike you as unsurprising.
Sir, when you say it's unsurprising, I don't know. I mean, what may be unsurprising is that, you know, if it vanishes in some region, it has to vanish in the forward light cone, because sure. You know, to translate there, I'm using this positive energy. But it is a bit surprising that it's telling us something about the space-like region. And that you haven't, you know.
Okay.
To translate outside of a space-like region, I don't really need to have a positive definite.
Let me talk about that, because let's go back to a scalar thing. Think about the Klein-Gordon equation, right? Hyperbolic equation, relativistically invariant, solutions propagate at speed c. You might think, okay, well, you know, I can just, you know, and for the Klein-Gordon equation, I can pick any Cauchy surface. I can give initial data on that, that determines it. And more or less, if I pick a point off that Cauchy surface, then the function is determined by initial data in its light cone, right? And so, yeah, why can't I just have something that's just non-zero? You know, when I specify my initial data, why can't I just have something that's non-zero only on part of it, and then it's only going to propagate in its light cone? So that's basically the question, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
This is where the surprise is.
Yeah, so here's where the surprise is. Good. So what I've just said is true in general for solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. However, if I restrict myself to the positive frequency subspace, that imposes a restriction on the data I can give on that. On this thing, because there is this it imposes a non-local relation between the time derivative. If I'm not restricted to the positive frequency subspace, I can just give initial data for the field and the time derivative any way I want on that, right? But I say no. I'm restricting yourself to the positive frequency subspace. That imposes a relation between values of the field on any space-like hypersurface and the time derivative. And there's just actually no way I can have both phi and phi dot non-zero everywhere outside a region. So if I've got if phi is non-zero anywhere, then phi dot is non-zero everywhere. So even if phi, way out here, if on this space-like slice, if phi is zero here, but phi dot is not zero, then it's going to be non-zero immediately off of it.
Is there any way to see that, or someplace where it's discussed? That's the surprising part.
Okay.
Does it follow from the uncertainty principle that phi dot r, you can't put both of them at zero?
What's that?
You can't put both of them to zero because they're conjugate operators.
I mean, this is just a property of the wave equation. It doesn't have to do anything with quantum mechanics.
It's a property of the wave equation, and there are places it's discussed. It's actually in quite a few textbooks, if you notice. But it's easy to see because, write down a general solution in terms of the momentum of eigenstates, and say actually I'm not just taking k, any old k on the, so for the Klein-Gordon equation, k has to be on the mass shell. But if you say, okay, no, I'm just taking the positive mass shell. You know, so write it as a Fourier transform. And then if you know phi of x, you know phi dot of x, and you can get phi dot of x explicitly as an integral over a whole surface of a term involving phi of x. So I chose. I thought about having that on a slide, but really, you know, I've told you enough to tell you how to do it. Yeah.
So just to clarify, so it's how the positivity is used.
Yeah.
It's a bit subtle, I guess, or surprising. So where, what, so k has to be positive, but where? Is it within that light cone zone, and that forces it to be positive everywhere, or what?
Okay.
Where am I requiring positivity?
Okay, yeah, so... So if it's if we take the Klein-Gordon equation as an example, so there, k has to obey the mass shell condition. So it's k naught squared k squared equals mu squared, and that'll give you two hyperbole in k space. And if I say okay, no, I'm only taking the positive frequency ones, I say I'm confining the k to be on the positive mass shell.
So far, so good.
Okay. All right.
The x part, but I'm so okay.
So all right. So, what's your question?
Well, I mean, it's am I requiring everywhere on a spatial slice that I have positive frequency, or am I requiring in some finite region, and I don't care what like. That's what I'm trying to understand. If I decompose phi within a finite region, am I requiring positivity of the spectrum? In
all right.
The Hilbert space should be functions on the positive frequency solutions.
Okay. Let me answer it. I think lots of people have the answer. So here's what I'm requiring. If I take my function phi of x, and I do a Fourier transform, then that only has components in the positive mass shell.
Phi of x over the entire space time, or just in one region? This is what I'm.
Let's see. Fourier transform is a global thing. So if I do a Fourier transform and go to the Fourier transform of that, if I want to know, if you write that down, if I want to know what the Fourier transform of this function is, I have to integrate the function over all, in this case, actually, integrating it all over a space-like surface suffices.
You're talking about functions defined globally
on
R4.
Yeah.
Not functions defined.
That's what I'm getting.
I think that's the question.
That's my question.
I'm talking about functions defined globally on R4. Yeah, absolutely. So for when I'm using the Klein-Gordon equation as an example, I'm talking about a function defined globally on R4 that satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation and moreover is restricted to the positive frequency subspace.
Globally over R4.
Yes.
Okay, so then the theorem is in a finite region of that, if I demand this global thing, this follows, which is what Laurent, I think, is getting at.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not surprising because you force this over all eternity.
Yes, yeah, so I think that's a good way to put it. To say you're in the, so if I'm putting a restriction on the Fourier transform of the function, that's a global restriction. That's not a restriction about the value of the thing at a point or something like that. That's, that tells you something about the function overall space-time.
Okay, but I guess what I might think is if I had the function defined in a finite region, and
right.
I just say all I care about is that I get positive frequency over a function defined in this finite region, I don't care what happens outside that, then what happens? That's sort of, like, maybe that's Laurent's question. That is, well, it's mine.
Okay.
So
okay.
Suppose all I care about is that phi, I have phi defined in some region.
Right.
And if I Fourier transform a phi defined only in that region, I get positive k.
Okay.
Positive
yeah, but that doesn't mean,
well,
you
I mean,
said,
I know the k will
zero,
spread out.
You said it to be zero.
Yeah, let's say it's zero outside.
Global.
Sorry?
Okay.
The notion of frequency is a global.
Yeah.
You would have a half.
Well, I know, but phi of x could be defined locally.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, somebody has a phi of x here and a different one here, and maybe these guys say I want all negative frequency, and these guys say I want all positive frequency.
But that's not how Fourier transforms work. If I say okay, if I've got a function that is, if I want the function to be non-zero only in a finite region of zero, then you have to have both positive and negative frequency turns in its Fourier transform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're not letting you do that.
Yeah. Right.
All
right. Right. So right. Yes. Good.
You even have to go off mesh.
What's that?
You also have, it has nothing to do even with positive or negative. It means you have to go off mesh.
Yeah.
It means that, you know, the very high frequency will be completely arbitrary. There will be no mesh condition.
Are you sure about that? We'll talk later.
Well,
it's a side point. Yeah.
It's on space time. If it happens to not be a solution to Klein Gordon, if you demand an arbitrary function on space time. It's not coming to mass shell precisely if it doesn't satisfy that.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
I have to get back to curved space time.
Okay.
What's that? You cannot have a global Fourier transform.
Yes.
You cannot define the Fourier transform very well.
Yes. That's why, yeah.
So we live in a curved space time, presumably.
Yes. So, all of this is assuming that I have that we're doing it in Minkowski space-time. So we don't live in curves in Minkowski space-time, right?
No.
Here's what I would say to that, and I think that's a very good question. I think that's an important question. Okay, we don't live in curved space-time. I mean, we don't live in Minkowski space-time. We live in a curved space-time. Now, when you actually do a calculation, say you want to calculate what you think is going to happen in the Large Hadron Collider, the relevant part of space-time is at least approximately flat, and I can get away with using a quantum field theory on a Minkowski space-time. So, something that if a quantum field theory is going to be a good approximation to whatever real theory I have, I'm sorry, if a quantum field theory on Minkowski space-time is going to be a good enough approximation, then anything that's, you know, robust under approximations about my quantum field theory under Minkowski space-time is going to be still true on that. Now, the question that I think you're asking is, okay, is there a generalization of this theory to interesting quantum field theories on a curved space-time? I do not know the answer to that.
I doubt it.
What's that?
I doubt it. And the other issue is that the Bunch-Davies vacuum corresponds to the Minkowski space-time vacuum.
Yeah.
But there are many different vacuum states in curved space-time.
Yes.
They have to be unitarily equivalent. You want to create a Taj Mahal in the Andromeda galaxy.
Right.
So
right.
I don't see how this could go through.
Um, You're right. I think that the theorem could be straightforwardly extended. Only the curved space times with lots of symmetry. But even there, I'm not sure. We have to be dealing with some kind of approximation in which we can approximate our theory by a theory of one Minkowski spacetime, or else this, So it's a theorem about quantum field theory on Minkowski spacetime, and I don't have anything useful to say about possible expansions to curved spacetime, so I'm going to move on. Raphael, what were you going to say?
It's a technical question. Have you used somewhere along the way, you pointed out you didn't use the space-like commutativity.
Right.
Did you use uniqueness of the vacuum or not?
What I did use is the idea that I've got a cyclic representation. I've got a state I've got a Hilbert space that consists of a state and things that can be approximated by acting on that state. So if you had two vacuums, and you had two sectors correspond to those vacuums, which are not unitarily equivalent, then you would not get this. Right. So that I have used, as you mentioned. Yeah.
Hack
theory. So all of this half has to happen within one sector. It does assume I've got a cyclic representation that I've got some vector and I can get anything I want or as close to anything I want to by acting on that vector. And you can sort of see that it has to. Because if I had a state that I couldn't get by acting on the vacuum with anything at all, ipso facto, I couldn't get that state by acting on the vacuum with something confined to some region. Right? Yeah. So, however, you could say, OK, all right, you know what? Even if I don't have, if I have a quantum field theory on Minkowski spacetime, and I didn't have a, I've got a whole bunch of unitary and equivalent representations. Well, that'll end up being, I can have a theory, a Hilbert space is the direct sum of those. And I could say, okay, the theorem is restricted with, any state in this sector can be approximated by acting on its vacuum with local operators. And actually, hold it, let me think about this, because, there's Hogg's theorem, but then there's also Fell's theorem that says, even if I do have unitarily inequivalent representations that take any state in the volume of this one, as long as I'm only concerned about excitation values of a finite number of observables, then I can get close as I want with states in the volume of the other one. So you still get the close enough. You still get the approximation. You can get close as you want. Yeah, even if you have unitarily inequivalent representations, as long as Fell's theorem applies, you can approximate states in the volume of one representation as closely as you want with states in the volume of the other one. Okay, so I take back what I said, still works. But what is required is that I do have a unitary representation of the translate of space-time translations, and that I can in a global way separate between positive frequency and negative frequency, and that's what breaks down in a curved space-time. Yeah, that's where it breaks down. Yep. Okay, can I move on? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So here's a generalization I was talking about. First definition, say that a vector is analytic in the energy operator P naught if, so that's, take that as a function of a complex argument Z, and if that converges everywhere in some disk in the complex plane containing the origin of non-zero radius, we'll say that the vector is analytic for the energy. That would obviously include the vacuum state, which is invariant under P naught. Then that function will converge everywhere. It's true if the energy the support in the energy spectrum of the vector is bounded. Yeah. If the expansion in terms of the energy of the vector goes down fast enough as the energy gets big enough, generalization of the Riesch-Leder theorem is that in the statement of the theorem, I can replace the vacuum with any vector analytic for the energy. Okay. Easy corollary is that the vacuum is not an eigenstate of any observable belonging to any region if there's a actually, I should say non-empty causal complement. If there's an open set that's space-like separated from that region, then the vacuum is not going to be an eigenstate of any observable associated with that region. It's easy. Left as an exercise. Again, it gets the same generalization. Okay, so I was saying if there's any counterintuitive about the Riesch-Leder theorem, it must be in what I've called unsurprising fact one. We've already talked about that bit. And you know, I think the thing that makes it surprising at first is the idea that for these wave equations, they're well-defined hyperbolic equations. The data, you only need data in the past light cone, but the restriction to a positive energy subspace is a global constraint on the function. In particular, you can't have a function that is in the positive frequency subspace and is confined to a finite region on any space-like hypersurface. And the easiest way to see that is if you just write down the function in terms of its Fourier transform and take the derivative, well, if I know its series expansion, and I know that the Fourier components are all in the positive mass shell, then I know its derivative. And the time derivative ends up being a function of the state of the field arbitrary far away. And that's the reason, we recall that in quantum elementary quantum theory, this Klein-Gordon propagator, it does not vanish its space-like separation. It's if you work it out, it's can be evaluated explicitly in terms of Bessel functions, and it's It's not a delta function. It's something sharply peaked and it falls off exponentially. If r is the distance from the origin, asymptotically, it's e to the minus mu r, where mu is the is the mass. But it doesn't go to zero, no matter how far away you are. And that is something that gets mentioned in the intro textbooks. And that is a consequence of this spectrum condition, the fact that you don't get zero propagator at space-like separation. Okay. All right, so I talked about that. I think that the way people talk about these particle creation operators, some people may get, you come away first when they first hear about it with the idea that, okay, if I operate, at a point X, okay, I've got a disturbance of the vacuum at X, and I've got something on some space-like hypersurface, and it's just like the vacuum everywhere else. But they're not like that. If I've got a state like that, then the expectation values are different from the vacuum expectation values everywhere, of some observables at least. And another way to say that is, if you've got a field theory and you've got disturbances of the vacuum corresponding what we intuitively call one particle, two particle, they're not strictly localized. They might be almost exactly like the vacuum in every region outside, except for a region of dimensions of the Compton wavelength, but those states are not exactly like the vacuum state anywhere. Okay. And just a little jargon, you say that a state is strictly localized in a region R if expectation values for all observables pertaining to things outside of R are the same as their vacuum expectation values. And in the same year that the Riesz-Schleider theorem was proven, using essentially the same mathematical techniques, these considerations of certain functions being analytic, what Knight proved is that no state of finite particle number, which was just short form, for no state that you can get from the vacuum by acting on with finitely many of these field operators, is strictly localized in any region whose complement contains an open set. Now, you might say, okay, well, are there any states then that are localized in some region that's not the whole space-time? And, well, yes. If I if I take my region R and I take some self-adjoint operator pertaining to that, exponentiated to form a unitary operator, act on that with a vacuum, act on the vacuum with that. Yeah. Any observable that is space-like separated, so if I have an observable B, any observable that's space-like separated from this region, R is going to commute with A, and so the expectation value minus. The expectation value of that state is just going to, those are just going to go right through, and it's going to be equal to its vacuum expectation value. So yeah, there are states that are different from the vacuum. So a state like that would be different from the vacuum only in the light cones of that region. So there are such things. But notice what I did is I took something here, and I exponentiated it. And if I write that as a series, it's not a, you know, it's not a, a polynomial of any finite degree. You have arbitrarily high high products of fields in that series expansion. So the restriction is if I take the vacuum and I act on it with some finite product of fields, then I don't get a strictly localized state. Okay, I just said all that. An example that Knight gives is, and this has actually become a textbook example. It's in Peskin and Schroeder. Take a scalar, free scalar field, and just add a classical source term to its Lagrangian, and what you get is that, you know, there's a single particle. What you get is, for any n, there's a finite probability of that field producing n particles, so you don't have a finite particle number of state. I can define single particle wave functions, two particle wave functions, three particle wave functions, and since that doesn't vanish at space-like separation, that doesn't vanish for x space-like from the region where my source field is. So you've got this kind of weird situation where, or maybe it's not so weird, you've got some region here. This is the region where, some finite region where my source field isn't zero. The resulting state is not a finite particle state. It's got, you know, has n particle components for arbitrarily high n. But it actually is a unitary transformation acting on the vacuum. And so expectation value of any observable out here is still going to be, in that state, is still going to be its vacuum expectation value, even though you've got all these one particle, two particle, three particle wave functions that are non-zero out here. And I think that that's worth thinking about, because I want to say that, okay, this is a state that is locally like the vacuum, because the vacuum out here.
Can you say again the statement?
Yeah, taking the observable out here, space-like separated from the source, its expectation value in that state is going to be its vacuum expectation value. But the state itself is not the vacuum state globally, and has one particle component, two particle component, et cetera, for arbitrarily high n particle components. And if you compute these wave functions, one particle wave function, two particle wave function, they're going to be non-zero everywhere, even though the state itself looks just like the vacuum out here, in the sense that the expectation values of observables out here are the same as the vacuum one.
But dispersion will not be.
What's that?
So expectation value are insensitive, but higher moments will not be insensitive.
All observables. So b squared. Yeah, these are all these are all things that commute with stuff here. So we're really just like the vacuum in all the statistics of any measurements. Now,
So in what sense is your definition of wave function in this context a good one?
Like, I'm sorry, what, I don't understand the question. If that, okay, so.
Wave functions for all k which are non-vanishing all over the place, but none of your observables can detect them. And like, in what sense are these wave functions?
They won't be detected out here. They'd be detected up here, up there. Right.
But
so,
if the
yeah.
Functions have support outside that region.
So the wave function itself is not an observable.
Yeah. No, I'm with you on that.
Okay.
So like, usually in quantum mechanics, wave functions, if they're like supported in a region, and then we take their norm squared or something. You know what I mean? There's some like the support of the wave functions really means something geometric in quantum mechanics.
Right.
And so if it doesn't have the same meaning here, then in what sense is it?
So, okay. I want to claim it actually does have that same thing. However, so you know, wave function is. Yeah, you know, in a state psi, I'm defining it to be that. Now, if this is a one particle state, if phi is a one particle state, then phi squared is actually going to be equal to the expectation of a value of an observable. It's going to be so within the one particle sector, I have that relationship between the wave function and the values of expectation values of local observables in the one particle sector. But in a state like this, which isn't a one particle state, that connection is broken. That's what I'm saying.
When you say one particle state, you really just mean a state gotten by acting on the
yeah, with one field.
One.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. That's all
it's
I mean.
It's not that there's some well-defined particle number.
No. Yeah, you might or might not have a well-defined global particle number. Yeah.
So if I insert a complete set of states there, they all vanish except for the zero part.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean that's in so that's what makes.
That's what makes that equal.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So So you know, we can define these when I've got you know states like this that aren't states of finite particle number or you know that are superpositions of states of you know, arbitrary n. I can still define all of these wave functions, but they don't have the same connection to observables that you might expect them to have from ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Where what we do in non-relativistic quantum mechanics is well, you know, you just got a fixed finite particle number. And so you're not talking about states at all, states like that at all. What I was saying is, you know, I think that thinking about this, you know, does help us think about these wave functions. They're not observables and there's a real sense in which, you know, if I write this down, okay, that's a well-defined function of x. But what value it takes at x depends on global properties of the state. And there's a temptation to think of these wave functions as being something like classical fields, which are local beables, you know, their wave function at a point in space-time, it you know tells you only about the state of affairs in a local neighborhood of that. But you know, what I want to claim is that no, that's not what they are. And you can have a state that's just like the vacuum state out here, even though it's a supervision of the states of our arbitrarily high particle number, and you've got all those wave functions that are non-zero out there, and the relationship between those wave functions and the expectation values of local observables that you might expect from ordinary quantum mechanics just gets severed in states like that. Okay, I'm running out of time. I want to get to the question about in the title. So, can we create the Taj Mahal? Does the Riesch-Vader theorem say that if we're in a situation where a field quantum field theory on Minkowski space-time is a good enough approximation, can we create the Taj Mahal? Well, how do we talk about what we can and can't do in quantum theory? Well, I think that the way that quantum information people tend to talk about it is the right one. Oops, I didn't mean to go that way. Want to go forward. Yeah, assume that any operation we can perform, there's going to be a Krauss representation of that operation, some set of operators. It could be a measurement, a von Neumann measurement, it could be a generalized measurement, such that some set of operators ki, such that the sum over all I of ki dagger ki is the identity. And what happens when I do the operation, starting with initial state vector r, the result is going to be the result of operating on that vector with one of those, and the probability for which one is going to be given by Born's rule. So I'm not going to argue here that that's a good way to think about operations in quantum theory, but it is fairly standard. So, and I'm going to take for granted that operations can be formed in a region R consists of operators belonging to that region. Okay. So suppose the initial state of Alice and Bob. Alice is in her lab on Earth, and Bob is on the back of the moon in his lab. Suppose it's one of those, on Werner's slide, he had vacuum in between, but we don't need it to be vacuum. It just has to be one of those states to which the Riesch-Vader theorem applies. Suppose it is. And then if there's a state of our theory that counts as having a Taj Mahal on the back of the moon, and the Taj Mahal is actually some finite arrangement of particles in a certain shape. So take some state that would count as having a Taj Mahal in the back of the room. By the Riesch-Vader theorem, there's some operator pertaining to Alice's lab that counts, that when operating on psi would count as a state in which there's a Taj Mahal in the back of the moon. And just add some other things to make a non-selective operation. So I'm going to have her do a one-zero test. And Bob on the back of the moon has a Taj Mahal detector corresponding to some effect E. And what's going to happen is Alice is going to perform her operation, record the result, and at space-like separation, Bob is going to turn his Taj Mahal detector on. Now, if she gets the result zero, then we're in the state K naught psi. And that's a state in which Bob has a high probability of detecting a Taj Mahal on the back of the moon. Okay. Did Alice create the Taj Mahal on the back of the moon? Well, remember that core I said, that if Bob has some operator pertaining to his lab out there, it's got a non-zero, he's got a Taj Mahal detector. It's got a non-zero probability of firing in the vacuum or firing in any state analytical in the energy, whether or not Alice performs her operation. If Alice's operations, if K naught commutes with that operator, then choosing to do that operation or not does not change the probability of Bob's Taj Mahal detector firing. What we have is a correlation. Bob's results are correlated with Alice. If Alice gets zero, then Bob is almost certain to get a yes for Taj Mahal, and vice versa. If Bob's Taj Mahal detector fires, then Alice is almost certain to get, say, zero. So what we have is an entangled state in which we have two experiments being done at space like separation with correlated results. This is not an unfamiliar situation. You might not expect, say, the vacuum, you might not have expected the vacuum state or arbitrary states that are analytic in the energy to be entangled across space-like regions, but they are. And once you realize that they are, then it's, you know, it's not surprising that there are experiments that can be done with correlated results. And whether we say one result causes the other one in this case is exactly the same as what we should say in, say, EPR Bell type experiments. I happen to think that cause and effect is an asymmetric relation. That if I say Alice's result causes Bob's, I shouldn't also say Bob's result causes Alice. So if I do say there's a cause or effect relation between the two, it better not be a situation in which there's symmetry between the two. And these experiments are cases like that. So I, for one, want to say is, okay, these correlations that we get between space-like separated experiments in an entangled state, they're not that all the sort of thing one would expect from classical mechanics, but attempt to say that one causes the other is trying to force it too much into a classical kind of view. But whatever you say about the correlated results of Alice in her lab and Bob and his Taj Mahal detector on the back of the moon is the same. What you should say about that is, whatever you say about the more familiar kinds of experiments with correlated results, space-like separation, whatever you say about that, you say more or less the same thing about the Taj Mahal experiment. Okay. That's where I wanted to be. So my answer to the title question would be actually no, it doesn't make sense to say that Alice created that Taj Mahal. Okay, but that's what I wanted to say. There are lots of questions during it, but yeah, Marcus.
So this means somehow probably you can turn this into a proof of ground state to be a very highly entangled state.
Yes.
Isn't it actually formulated as a theorem in that context when you look at the books?
Yes. It's a straightforward corollary of the Rieck-Feder theorem that, yeah, this ground state is a highly correlated state. And in fact, if you have two Rindler wedges, then you can always find observables associated with each one of them that violate Bell inequalities in the vacuum. So yeah, vacuum fluctuations violate Bell inequalities. That's a theorem due to Stephen Summers and Reinhard Werner. It's believed that the same is true for any two space-like separated regions. But as far as I know, it has not been proven. But yeah, but for certain kinds of space-like separated regions, in particular, Rinder wedges, yes. Vacuum fluctuations violate Bell inequalities. But they drop off really fast with distance, because, this E to mu R thing. Yeah.
This is more in the nature of a comment. So in your conclusion, you proved that even if in any region R we could do any one of those operations that you sketched for us, we still, so some we could still not create a Taj Mahal somewhere. But the comment is that it's also, we know that even the assumption, so what I'm going to say won't affect that conclusion, mm-hmm. but you might ask, is it really true that in any given region R, we can do any one of those operations? And I claim the answer is no. If you assumed that, then you would get into trouble with causality. You would be able to transmit information faster than light. So
you can't
there,
do it deterministically, is the point.
What?
You can't do it.
No, I'm just saying you cannot, for example, do a measurement of any, within that region, do a ideal measurement of any operator defined in that region.
Okay.
There are some that you could do and some you could not do.
Okay,
I know it's not completely understood which ones are which.
Okay, let's talk about that later because I'm not quite. I'm not quite sure I understand, because if I have, if I have a set of operators, if my operation is characterized by a set of operators Ki, then that operation will leave the statistics associated with anything that commutes with all of those unchanged.
That's right.
Okay. All right, so that's not what you're saying. So what I'm saying is, so the assumption is that for any such set, if those are operators associated with a region, then that's an operation I can do.
Claiming that assumption is invalid. And there's a protocol that if you make that assumption, then you can transmit information faster than light, but not just by doing what you said. So you need a set of three regions. You need an initial, say, A or Alice or Alia, whoever you like. Another one, then you need a sort of spread out space-like region for your R. And then you need a B, which is Bob or whoever you like, which is to the future of that, but space-like to the first one. And then the person in the middle does an agreed upon operation of this nature. And then B can tell whether or not A did a measurement.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. This coming back to me. I've seen you talk about this before. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Right. Okay. I understand now. Wait, yeah. Thank you for that.
Is there a really quick way to what's going on there? Like, I want to be able to say you can locally do any POVM. So.
Well, it depends what you mean by local.
Okay.
You mean a point. Of course, you can't do anything at a point.
Sure.
The field there. So if by local you mean within a space, a given space-time region. Then I want to say no, you cannot.
Is there a quick name for whatever this counterexample is? Or is it an obvious way to say it?
Is this in a paper that?
It's a paper. The most recent is by I think Preskill and Gottesman. They gave an example of it. The original one was in a paper that I wrote in a birthday fest trip for Dieter Brill and Charlie Miz, or Dieter Brill, I think it was. But it's, I don't know a name for it. And there's also a related, very closely related by Aharonov and Weidman, I think.
Yeah.
Discussed in a non-relativistic context. Right. But it's essentially the same effect.
Other questions or comments? Well, thank everyone for coming out. I thank everyone for the comments and questions during the talk.